On episode 474 of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we bring back Dr. Sarah Myhill and discuss her book, The Energy Equation, From the Naked Ape to the Knackered Ape. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/474. Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness? The 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. I'm your host, Alan Meisner. I'm an NSAM certified personal trainer with a specialization in corrective exercise and fitness nutrition. Let me be your coach as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go. If you've listened to the podcast over the last few weeks, you've probably heard me talking about my 12-week weight loss program that's been in pre-launch. We went through that pre-launch program with a select group of people, and the results have been astounding. I'm really excited about where things are going. If you have 15 or more pounds to lose and you're ready to commit, I'm building a wait list for the full program. This will be a select invitation-only group of people that will go through this 12-week program with a guaranteed weight loss of at least 15 pounds. So if you're committed and you're ready and you have more than 15 pounds to lose, this is your chance. Go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/list. I'm going to be picking in order from the order that people sign up onto this list to decide who makes it into the program and who doesn't. If this is for you and you really do want to lose the weight, go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/list and get on the waiting list today. Raz, how's your week going?
Good, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. In the 80s, during the day and 70s at night, my wife and I are starting to try to do our transition move over to the bed and breakfast she bought. Our rent runs out at the end of March for our apartment. So she pretty much wants to be moved over there. And you know, here you can't really leave a property unattended overnight. People will break in and steal things. So we have to stay there some. Well, stay there, I guess. I go by the apartment every once in a while just to see it's still there, but because I'm paying rent. But yeah. So we're doing kind of a move right now, and then of course I did get the gym open February 1st, and so trying to run the gym, and it's slow grow, and we got people coming in, but it's nice to have that going again. So it's good times. How about you?
Sounds exciting. Well, we're the exact opposite of you right now. We have some Arctic air coming in. So we're in the single digits, and sometimes those have a negative in front of them as well. So I'm avoiding the outside while we are in those single digits and spending some time in my gym. So I just did a spin bike for about an hour this morning and doing some drills and just trying to keep warm as best I can.
I'm going to tell you this. This morning, I think it might have got down to all the way to 70.
Oh gosh, I would love that right now.
So I would say it was like probably, for the folks that are doing Celsius, probably about 22 degrees Celsius. And I was cold. I was like, I'm about to put a sweatshirt on.
Oh my gosh. I need 3 layers of clothing if I even go outside to get the mail.
Yeah, you'll lose toes.
Right. Yep. Yep.
But I did see on Facebook that I guess Holland or New Holland, I forget the city name.
Holland, yeah.
Has heated sidewalks. So that's cool. Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't know a ton about it, but I believe that there's a wastewater treatment plant downtown or a plant of some sort where they need to recirculate their water. And when it comes out all nice and hot, it needs to go somewhere. So why not underneath the sidewalks of the downtown? So this heated water goes through all these coils underneath these beautiful brick sidewalks. They've got about almost 5 miles at this point of sidewalks that are heated through this treatment plant's hot water. And it's amazing because It can melt snow at such a rate. So even when it's snowing, full-blown snow, like we get in Michigan, it is able to keep up with certain inches per hour, a couple inches per hour of snow, which is quite a bit. So when we got there the other day to run the heated sidewalks, there was dry brick pavement to run on, no slipping and sliding, not even slush. And it's stark contrast because the roads are totally full of snow. We actually got probably about 7 inches of snow over the weekend. So it's amazing to see these perfectly dry sidewalks in stark contrast to the snowy roads. It's pretty amazing.
Okay. So when are you going to make Michael do that with your running path?
We are so close. That'll be our summer project, maybe. Because there's houses that have these sidewalks that go along the side of their house. So they literally don't have to shovel that portion of their sidewalk, which I'm telling you would just be heaven. It's pretty amazing.
But shoveling is good exercise too.
It is a good workout for sure.
All right. Yep. So today we have on Dr. Sarah Myhill, and she did the PK cookbook, which is a paleo keto cookbook. And today we're going to talk about her book, The Energy Equation. So are you ready to get into that?
Let's go.
Our guest today was qualified in medicine with honors from Middlesex Hospital Medical School in 1981 and has since focused tirelessly on identifying and treating the underlying causes of health problems, especially the diseases of civilization, which all of us over 40 clearly understand. With no further ado, here's Dr. Sarah Myhill. Dr. Myhill, welcome back to 40 Plus Fitness.
Thank you for inviting me, Alan. You're always a very good questioner.
Well, good, good. Now, the last time we had you on, we were talking about the PK cookbook, which was the Paleo Ketogenic cookbook. Very good cookbook, by the way. Very good approach towards nutrition. And now your new book is The Energy Equation, From the Naked Ape to the Knackered Ape. and you did in the book, you explained, okay, knackered for you Americans out there just means tired or exhausted. And you know, when I have a conversation with someone about, you know, when they want to go in and get into personal training, I'll be like, okay, what's going on? And, you know, of course there's the weight gain and there's the other things that they're worried about. But I hear fatigue in just Yes. about every single one of those conversations.
Yeah. Fatigue is the commonest symptom that presents in Western medicine and the worst treated.
I agree, because in many cases we don't know what we don't know. You know, you get tired, and most people will say, well, that's just getting old. You know, you're just getting old. You gotta slow down.
Yeah, but age doesn't cause anything. Age is not a mechanism. Age is a clinical picture. Age doesn't cause, you see, we have to ask, you know, what is it about age that causes fatigue? And I think that age is greatly blamed for fatigue when there are other eminently treatable aspects.
Right. Now, we're not talking about the, you know, I didn't get enough sleep last night for, you know, I sleep well every other night, so I'm just a little tired, or I went out and did a you know, 4-hour walk or run, and now I'm really knackered. So we're talking about the chronic fatigue syndrome and myalgic encephalitis, you know, kind of these deep rooted conditions that we're going to be going through, that we could be going through.
Well, that's one part of the spectrum. Now, I learned so much about treating the symptom of fatigue through my work with patients with ME and chronic fatigue syndrome. But what I since find is that exactly the same principles applied to people who are, you know, otherwise well will improve their energy levels and improve their level of functioning. And even more importantly, when you apply these techniques to athletes, you improve their level of functioning as well. So the techniques we're going to talk about today are common to everybody. It doesn't matter if you've got chronic fatigue syndrome, if you're old, if you're young, if you're well, if you're a top athlete. We can all improve our energy mechanisms by attention to these details.
Yeah, and I think the deeper concept here, it kind of hit me in the gut a little bit, was that if you feel like you're suffering from fatigue, and you know, the root causes of it are kind of the same metabolic problems that we have that cause cancers, coronaries, diabetes, dementia, just everything that we equate to getting old.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. And not only do you improve how you feel now, but by putting in place those interventions, you greatly protect yourself from the risk of those nasty diseases that you described. And that's why it's so important. We should all do it now. You know, don't wait for something nasty to happen. You know, really grasp the nettle now.
Now you use the title. It's called the energy equation. And I love that because it's a conversation that comes up all the time when we're talking about weight loss. You know, it's energy in, energy out, and calories in, calories out. And I try to explain people that, you know, it's not that thermodynamics doesn't work in the human body. It does, but we've got it backwards, I think. we have it backwards. The trying to burn out the calories and do more and get more done, and just the modern lifestyles we have and the approaches we have towards energy, it's kind of backwards, isn't it?
Yes, what we know for absolutely for sure is that part that you described, i.e. you know, it's calories in and calories out, there's no relationship to effective weight loss. Because if you reduce the calories that you are eating, then the body thinks, oh, we're in starvation mode. There's a famine. And it shuts down energy burning. And if the body shuts down energy burning, that makes you fatigued. It makes you the foggy brain. You can't think clearly. It makes you depressed. It makes you anxious. Everything slows down. And that is no fun at all. The body just balances up energy burning or calories burnt to calories consumed. So there's much more effective ways of losing weight, which we can come on to, which do not involve calorie restriction.
I think one of the keys here, as I was getting into it, and you quoted someone, I can't remember the exact quote because it was in English, but it was kind of an older English, but and it was old currency. So the basic premise was that, you know, the opposite of fatigue is effectively having a slight energy surplus, where we have just a little more energy than we need to function well. And then that extra energy gives us the energy to decide, hey, I feel good. I think I'll go for a run or a bike ride or, you know, a hike or something. Talk a little bit about how we should view the energy in part of this equation.
Okay. Well, the point here is we all have a certain bucket of energy that we can spend in a day. Now, if we spend more energy than we have available to us, then we die. Because if you haven't got the energy for the heart to work, for the brain to work, for the gut to work, then the body will simply die. Now, the brain and the body cannot therefore permit you to spend more energy than you have available to you. And so what it does is it gives you symptoms which warn you that your energy bucket is starting to empty. And in the book, The Energy Equation, I detail those symptoms. They're symptoms we all know about: fatigue, no stamina, short of breath, foggy brain, can't think clearly. And then the brain gives us symptoms that stop us spending energy, like depression, like anxiety. So symptoms are very important. They guide us. They tell us about that energy gap. But if you've got plenty of energy, if you've got an abundance of energy, but for all the reasons we can talk about, then, you know, then you have the ability to spend it. And then you can go out training and not pay for it the next day. Yes, you know, and get physically fit. Yes, you can take on mental projects, new businesses, new horizons, new hobbies, because you have the mental energy to deal with that. So what that means is there's two sides to the energy equation. First of all, I have to advise you how to make your energy bucket as large as is possible, so you've got plenty of energy to spend in a day. And then we have to look at how the body is spending energy and maybe wasting energy. Because the gap between the two gives us the energy to have a life with, and spending energy mentally, spending energy physically is having fun. It's called living life. So the technique to say make, as I call it, the holes in the energy bucket smaller, but improves the mechanisms by which we generate energy, so we have plenty to go at. I think of energy as money. Now, without money, we can't live. And if you've got an abundance of money, you can go out and have a lot of fun and have a jolly good time. If you're wasting money, then you haven't got the money to spend on the things you like doing. It's exactly the same with energy.
Now, you mentioned something that is really, really important, is the kind of the leakage, the holes in the bucket, if you will. You know, most people, when you start talking about energy, they're thinking in terms of, oh, I need to exercise to burn energy. And that is one way that we would use some of the energy that's available to us. But it's actually a very small percentage of what we would actually use in a day. Can you talk about some of the energy outs and why it's critical for us to make sure that we have an abundance of energy coming in to be able to handle these functions?
Well, you know, an astonishing statistic in my mind is that about 2/3 of all the energy that the body generates just goes in staying alive. That's called basal metabolism, you know, keeping warm, the heart beating efficiently as a pump, you know, the brain working efficiently. I mean, at rest, although the brain weighs just 2% of body weight, it consumes 20% of all the energy that the body generates. So the brain is using an enormous amount. But the organ that uses the most energy of all is the liver. And the liver at rest uses 27% of all the energy that the body generates. And the reason for that is the liver has to deal with what comes from the gut. The liver is there to mop up the toxic products that come from the gut. And although we think food is good for us, and of course it's essential for life, food is actually a potentially toxic soup. And if you eat, you know, poor quality food, you will end up with a fermenting gut. And when you've got a fermenting gut, you will be fermenting those sugars and carbohydrates to alcohol, to D-lactate, to hydrogen sulfide. You will be producing lots of bacteria and fungi with bacterial endotoxin and fungal mycotoxin. And that all gets absorbed and it goes in via the portal vein to the liver. And the liver has to deal with that toxic soup. And that requires a lot of raw materials and a lot of energy. So the liver is the most energy consuming department of the body. So what that tells us is simply by improving our diet, and you mentioned the paleo-ketogenic diet opening, simply by getting onto a low carbohydrate, paleo-ketogenic diet, you greatly reduce the work that the liver has to do. And if the liver's not using the energy, then it's there for you to use. And so many people, just by doing the diet, turn around to me and say within a couple, 3 weeks, my energy is back. I've suddenly got my sparkle. I feel 20 years younger. I now know this is how I should be. So the diet is absolutely central to energy delivery mechanisms for that one simple reason. It just reduces the work we have to spend on the liver for just basal metabolism.
Yeah, and to take that one level deeper, you know, there's these things that'll come out on the market, you know, raise your metabolism so you can lose weight. And every time I see one of those, I just cringe, because that's the exact opposite of what we should be trying to do. You know, our metabolism is going to be what it's going to be. We can improve it just with the quality of our food and some exercise and other basic functional things we can just do for ourselves. But, you know, people will try to take these stimulants, basically, and they're like bashing a big hole in their
correct.
Bucket.
Yeah, I call it flogging a dead horse. That's a saying we have in this country. You know, yes, you can beat them. They'll do a bit more work, but it's counterproductive in the long term. So supplements to stimulate metabolism is not, you know, does not work. And the most important thing is, first of all, we have to improve energy delivery mechanisms. And then, as I call it, look how we are wasting energy. And the gap between the two gives us energy to spend on having a jolly life. So the energy equation is all about making that gap as wide as possible.
Right. And there's study after study that the lower your metabolism, the longer you live. And that's all part of making it a lot easier to balance this equation. You know, if you're basically doing the right things for your body and your body is optimized, you know, the mitochondria are firing and they're doing what they're supposed to do. You're turning, you know, the ATP around and, you know, everything's just not kind of working for you. The energy just blows out because you stored all this body fat and now your body can say, hey, we don't need this anymore. You know, the liver can get busy because it's got all the energy it needs. And it's like, okay, now we can do the cleaning up that we need to do as we get rid of this body fat. And it just really kind of is this self-fulfilling prophecy that's backwards in our head. You know, it's not about getting your metabolism to work faster. It's about optimizing your health so you have an optimized metabolism.
It's all about efficiency. And the other thing to remember that is so important is we spend energy even during sleep. And it's during sleep that the immune system heals and repairs. So, you know, you can't work, you can't generate energy, you can't do physical exercise, you can't do brain exercise without creating some damage in the body. And with good quality sleep and energy, and of course, raw materials, the immune system then heals and repairs. So this diet and these interventions stop you degenerating. And you know, degenerative disease is now a major cause of morbidity in people as they get older. So, you know, it's just good all round. There's, you know, you absolutely can't go wrong with these regimes.
Now, since we're talking about optimizing and efficiency and trying to keep our, you know, basically say keep our energy out in balance with our energy in and all that, why is it still important to exercise? Because that's burning energy. Why would we still want to exercise?
Well, because exercise is, well, first of all, we are functional animals. And primitive man, if he didn't exercise, if he couldn't use his body, then he would simply die from starvation. So we have had millions of years where for optimum health and optimal function, we have to use our bodies. One example of this is if you send astronauts up into space where there's no gravity, moving around is very easy. You know, it's they don't need to use their muscles. They get roaring osteoporosis and they get terrible muscle wastage. You know, it's the old story. If you don't use it, you lose it. And to be well, we have to have good structure. We have to have strong bones, strong connective tissue. And to maintain that, we need a certain amount of energy. And of course, there are exercise techniques which will optimize that so we can do that most efficiently. But the primary thing is to, I say, make the energy bucket as large as possible. And the analogy that I give to my patients is the car analogy. And for your car to go, and I like that analogy because I get it and my patients get it. And for your car to go, there are four important players. You've got to have the right fuel in the tank. And we talk about that in the book. It's got to be low carbohydrate because modern diets are far too high in carbs. And we get addicted to them and we crave them and they ferment and that makes us fatigued. So the priority is low carbohydrate. And then we have to have, as I call it, the mitochondrial engine. And all mammal cells, you know, in fact, all cells in nature pretty much that you look at, you know, except yeast. So plant cells, tree cells, mammal cells, insect cells, they are all powered by mitochondria. It's like we have an engine that is common to all cells, and every living cell will be powered by those mitochondria. And I think of those as the engines because they take fuel from the bloodstream, which should be ketones. That is the preferred fuel for mitochondria, not sugars. Ketones from the bloodstream, which they burn in the presence of oxygen to generate the energy molecule ATP. So, and there are some supplements which are very commonly deficient. And as you may not know, I've now published three papers about mitochondrial function in patients with fatigue syndromes. And the bottom line is the more fatigued you are, the worse your mitochondrial function and vice versa. I then put in, and there are very common rate limiting steps, just like there are common reasons why your car engine might fail. It might fail because, I'm only there about old engines, but the spark plugs don't work, the fuel filter is blocked, and the timing isn't correct. It's the same with mitochondria. Common things are common. And the five deficiencies that come up time and time again, which make mitochondria go slow, are coenzyme Q10, acetyl-L-carnitine, vitamin B3, magnesium and D-ribose. Those five supplements come up time and time again. And I reckon it takes about 4 months of those supplements and your mitochondrial function has a very good chance of improving. That works reliably well. Then we have to ask if our mitochondria blocks by something. So, you know, you could have, you know, a first class, you know, engine, but if you throw some sand into it, it's going to block that engine up in unpredictable ways. It might block the fuel supply, it might block the air filters or whatever. And we live in a toxic, polluted world. So our mitochondria can go slow because we have been poisoned by something. I have to say, probably the number one cause of poisoning are products of the upper fermenting gut. If you're eating a diet which is high in sugars and carbohydrates, then there's a great risk that you will start to ferment. And what do you ferment those sugars and carbohydrates to? Alcohol, D-lactate, ammoniacal compounds, bacterial endotoxin is produced, fungal mycotoxin is produced, and all those things poison the mitochondria. So again, your diet is so important in this respect. But I learned so much of my stuff from seeing veterans of the Gulf War who'd been poisoned by organophosphates, pesticides, and organophosphates inhibit oxidative phosphorylation for obvious biochemical reasons. I saw firemen with 9/11 syndrome who had been poisoned. I see people with sick building syndrome who had been poisoned, and their mitochondria are going slow. So the detox regimes are often very helpful to improve mitochondrial function in those people. And then for your car to go, you've got to have a thyroid accelerator pedal, and that sets how base loads and sets how fast mitochondria can go. And then you need the adrenal gearbox, and that allows us to gear up to stress. So, you know, when I go to work, then that's stressful. You know, I have to gear up my energy production so I can be an effective doctor. But I can't do that 24 hours a day. I can run in overdrive for some hours a day, but in the evening I have to gear back down to second gear to first gear. I put my feet up, do a crossword, read a book, watch some telly, or whatever. And that ability to gear up and down and match energy delivery to energy demands very closely is an essential part of using energy efficiently. I mean, one example of this, for example, is if you had a patient with thyrotoxicosis, which is, an abnormal state of the thyroid gland when their accelerator pedal is stuck at 100 miles an hour. They burn loads of energy. Okay, they might feel wonderful for a short time because they have this apparent excess of energy, but the weight drops off them, the heart goes too fast, and eventually they end up with pathology. So balancing that all up, those four big players, together, of course, with sleep and exercise, as you mentioned before, are how we sort energy delivery mechanism. And there's no reason why your energy bucket can't be as full as you get older as it was when you were younger.
Okay. Now, one of the things I think that's important when we're talking about exercise, one of the benefits is if you do exercise the right way, you're not overstressed and you're able to recover. One of the cool things about our body is it adds mitochondria.
Absolutely.
And more mitochondria means more engines. So you're going from a, 8-horsepower vehicle to a 12-horsepower vehicle. And that's kind of one of the cool things about exercise is it helps us be more efficient and actually have more energy output for those times when we need it.
And a very good clinical test that anybody can do, which determines how many mitochondria they've got, is their pulse rate at rest. And we all know that the top athletes, as they get fitter, their pulse rate gets slower and slower and slower at rest. And that's because they pack their heart with mitochondria. So when the heart beats, it's a very powerful beat. And Steve Redgrave, for example, who was our Olympic athlete who won 4 gold medals at rowing, when he was in full training, his heart rate at rest was about 40 beats per minute because his heart was so big and beating so powerfully that he could maintain circulation with just 40 beats per minute. Now, it is a feature of my patients with chronic fatigue syndrome that they don't have the numbers of mitochondria and they don't work well. And their resting pulse is often quite high, 85, 90, maybe 95 beats per minute. And that is a measure of how powerful the heart is and therefore how many mitochondria it has and how effectively they are working. So resting pulse is a very good, clinical clue for anybody who's listening in to this.
Yeah, and we improve that by increasing our cardiovascular fitness through those types of exercises, cardio, and by doing weightlifting, getting
more
mitochondria going.
Yeah, and what stimulates more mitochondria is lactic acid burn, i.e., we have to push our muscles so much that we switch into anaerobic metabolism, and lactic acid, of course, is that makes your muscles painful, that makes them ache. It's the old story, no pain, no gain, because it's lactic acid that stimulates more mitochondria. So if you want to get your muscles bigger, you have to do anaerobic exercise. exercise. If you want to have them more efficiently, then more aerobic exercise. But if you think about it, you know, the long distance runners who run great distances, they don't have big muscles. You know, they've trained their muscles to be, they're light, they're swift on their feet, but their mitochondria working very efficiently. But by contrast, those sprinters, the weightlifters with the big muscles, they have to have a lot of mitochondria. And the heart is about 25% by weight mitochondria, and muscles are also about 20% by weight mitochondria. So the engines form a large part of our muscle bulk.
And so for most of us, the performance that we're looking for in our day-to-day lives, a little bit of both goes a long way.
Exactly, exactly. And so my view is we should all be doing a bit of anaerobic and a bit of aerobic exercise every day. And that should be part of your daily routine. And once, you know, you're doing a little bit of exercise, it doesn't have to be drastic. You know, it becomes a pleasurable part of your day. And guess what? You know, we all have a deep biological need for a view, and that's called being out in nature, being out in the countryside. And we all know that just getting out there, getting outside and having a view, whether it's the local park or the lake or the seaside or whatever, is very good for us. It makes us feel good mentally, and it's good for us physically.
And we get some sunshine, which is also very good for us in our energy equation.
Vital, indeed.
Now, one of the things that our body does to protect us is it will take pollutants, it'll take things that are not supposed to be there, and it likes to try to get them out of us, or it likes to put them away where they won't bother us for a while. And so in the book, you talked about persistent organic pollutants, POPs. So I want to kind of get into that, because I think, you know, one of the things I tell my patients, my clients, is that if they start losing weight, they might feel a little bad at first, because they basically have created a toxic environment inside their body while their liver now is struggling to catch up. So can you talk a little bit about what POPs are and how we should manage those?
Absolutely. I mean, I learned so much about this because especially when I was treating those poison patients I mentioned earlier, I used to do a lot of fat biopsies. Now, it's a very easy test to do, and it means we could measure the POPs which are in fat directly. And the fascinating thing was I never had a normal result. Everybody that I did a fat biopsy in were carrying POPs. So these days I rarely do that test on my patients because I know what the result's going to be. And you know, even those who've done as many detox regimes as is possible, they still have a certain amount there. And that reflects the fact that we live in a toxic world. And however hard you try, you can never get rid of every last persistent organic pollutant. And they are pesticide residues. They are fire retardants that is in all furnishings. They're benzene compounds. They're solvents that we get from printed newspaper or from cleaning chemicals or from external air pollution. So we are all carrying these POPs. And my view is we all should do the best we possibly can to reduce the load. As you rightly point out, the body in the short term tries to get these POPs out the way by dumping them in fat. Now, when I do a fat biopsy, the result of that comes back in milligrams per kilogram. If I do a blood test, the result comes back in micrograms per kilogram. That's a thousandfold difference. So the concentration of POPs in fat is a thousand times higher than that in the bloodstream. And what that means is that if you lose a kilogram of fat, you're going to be mobilizing, you know, milligrams of persistent organic pollutants into the bloodstream. And that gives you an acute poisoning and you can feel dreadful. And believe you me, some of my patients do. Now, one way to help mitigate this is to do some sort of heating regime. Now, I don't think it matters what heating regime we use, because I've put my patients through all sorts, but it might be a hot bath with maybe Epsom salts in the bath. It might be sunbathing. If you're fit enough to exercise, then do exercise. Saunering, which might be Turkish bath or dry saunering, but get warm. And the point is that mobilizes the fats in the mobilizes the POPs in the subcutaneous fat onto the lipid layer on the surface of the skin. And then you shower off. And the point of washing off that lipid layer takes the POPs with them. And from some years of experience in doing tests, a rough rule of thumb is about 50 of those regimes will halve your total body load. And the levels come down exponentially. So at least once a week, we should all be doing some sort of heating regime. Now, if you've got the energy to, then going and having a run and having a shower after, perfect. If you haven't got the energy and you've got sunshine, sunbathing is wonderful. If you haven't got the sunshine, then, okay, hot bath, a sauna or a fire infrared sauna or whatever works just as well. And my view is that is now something that we should all be doing as a routine to try to keep our toxic load down. And of course, in addition to that, do your very best to avoid these chemicals. As I said, you just can't avoid all of them. We're all exposed, but you just have to do your best. Keep your diet as clean as you possibly can. Keep your environment as clean as you possibly can.
Yeah, the liver is just kind of a cool organ because it's what it's doing is making its job as easy as it possibly can by storing this in the fat. So just recognize that it's not cheating you in any way. It's just basically trying to help you have the best energy balance. And so it's doing the easiest, quickest way for it to offload a lot of these chemicals, which were everywhere. So, it's not, we can't avoid them, but they're there. So our liver's doing what it's supposed to do. But the opposite side is on the other side, we're mobilizing this. So it's something for us to be aware of if we go through weight loss that we may have some other symptoms, some issues that we need to just buff through. And as like my doctor says, if you want to be healthy, sweat every day. Just find a way to sweat every day and you'll be doing a good on your body.
One small thing I would just warn you about is when you sweat, sweat is blood, but minus the white cells and the red cells and the proteins. So if it's in the plasma, a lot of it comes out in the sweat. So what that means is when you sweat, you lose electrolytes. Now, that's not just sodium and potassium. Yeah. That's also magnesium, copper, chromium, selenium, boron, it's the whole shebang. And so if you do a lot of sweating regimes, you must ensure that you rehydrate properly with electrolytes and all the minerals. Now, I have a preparation that I've made up called sunshine salt, which unfortunately we can't get to America. But if you are doing a lot of exercise, then it's really important you rehydrate. And don't forget magnesium. Now, I'll just tell you a little story about this. We have a competition in this country, the Great Northern Run, which is a half marathon. Now, I think it was 2008 or thereabouts. 10,000 runners ran it, and it was a particularly hot day. And they were sweating a lot. And during the course of that race, 4 runners dropped dead. Now, when it came to post-mortem, it all looked normal. They were told, their family was told, oh, this is sudden adult death syndrome. Well, that's no diagnosis at all. That's just a clinical picture. But I'm quite sure in my own mind that they died of acute magnesium deficiency. Why? You need calcium for the muscles of the heart to contract. And you need magnesium for the muscles of the heart to relax. Now, when you are running a lot in that very hot weather, you are losing buckets of magnesium. And I'm quite sure they induced an acute magnesium deficiency. The heart contracted in systole with calcium, and there wasn't the magnesium to allow diastolic function for it to relax. And their hearts just stopped. And that's what happened in all 4 cases. They were running on looking fine, and then suddenly they went down. And there was no other detectable pathology. They hadn't had a stroke, they hadn't had a heart attack, and I'm quite sure in my own mind that was magnesium deficiency.
Yeah, and we're talking about a ketogenic diet, and as a nature of a ketogenic diet, we also flush some extra fluid, so we're not carrying as much. And so when we flush that fluid, we flush some electrolytes. So yes, most people that are trying a ketogenic style diet need to look at their electrolytes very carefully, and where necessary, make sure that you're supplementing. Potassium and sodium are the easy ones because you get the cramps and you kind of know something's going on there. But that goes to magnesium and copper and the rest of them. If you're not getting what your body needs, the symptom of the thing you might deal with might be a lot more drastic than you want it to be. So, pay attention to your electrolytes and your fluids if you're going to do ketogenic. And yes, if you're out exercising in the extreme heat or even the extreme cold will often help cause dehydration of some level. So staying hydrated is critical. Now, one of the things you got into, you called your interventions, and there's 3 levels of it. So BAC, but you called it Groundhog. And one of the reasons I just love that is that I was actually born on Groundhog's Day. So,
oh,
so she's like, talking groundhogs. All right, now I'm into this book now. can you talk about these interventions, when each one makes the most sense, and general overview?
Okay. Well, the point is you know, when a patient comes to see me, then they're not even, you know, as I call it, on the starting blocks. You know, they're way behind the starting blocks, and there are some interventions we have to do just to get even, just to get us on an evolutionary correct regime. You know, this is where primitive man was, and these are the regimes we should all be doing all the time. You know, if we live in a Western society. And because clinically, I keep coming back to talking about these things over and over and over again, I call them groundhog regime. Because just like the film where our hero comes back to the day one again and tries to relive the day, you know, all over again, it's the same principle. And groundhog basic is the starting point to treat all Western disease. You know, it's the paleoketogenic diet, it's a basic package of supplements, it's discipline about sleep, exercise, detoxing, and so on. It's just what we should all be doing to maintain the status quo. And that's it, groundhog basic. Now, but of course, life doesn't continue in an unstressful, easy way. Sooner or later, we will pick up an infection. Now, I wrote a book two or three years ago called The Infection Game. And in my researches in that book, I realized that all chronic pathology has an infectious driver. You know, dementia is often associated with herpes viruses, for example. All cancers have an infectious associate. The one that most people know about is Helicobacter pylori, in the stomach bug, drives stomach cancer and other tumors. Epstein-Barr virus, you know, drives many hematological malignancies. So I realized that getting an acute infection, we need to deal with it very effectively, very quickly, get rid of it, in order that it doesn't get into the body, remain there, and drive chronic pathology. So the next regime that everybody has to be aware of is groundhog acute. Now, what do you do in the event of an acute infection? And of course, this is very pertinent now because these regimes are extremely effective in getting rid of COVID-19. And if you've got, you know, the groundhog basic in place, and then at the first sign of getting COVID-19, you take vitamin C to bowel tolerance, you will survive it perfectly well without any problems or complications whatsoever. So vitamin C to bowel tolerance is probably the most important tool of groundhog acute. But of course, people don't come to me, well, they don't come to me, you know, saying, oh, you know, and how can I live to 100? You know, they come to me sick or elderly, and they know they're not functioning to their full extent. And so as chronic disease comes in, whatever that chronic disease may be, and I see cancer patients, I see patients with advanced heart disease, I see patients with early dementia, we have to put in even more regimes over and above groundhog acute in order to deal with those chronic pathologies. So you have to do all the groundhog basic regime, but in spades. We have to do them harder. We have to be more disciplined about the diet, maybe take a few more supplements, maybe do some more detoxing, maybe pay more attention to the adrenals and the thyroid. And so groundhog chronic is probably what we should all be doing as we get older. And we should certainly be putting that in place if any pathology strikes, whether that's diabetes, heart disease, cancer, or whatever.
Well, I do agree. You know, as we went through these interventions, I was like, you know, yeah, these are lifestyles that, you know, are not, they're not insane. They're not crazy. I can't do this for a long period of time. And granted, you might come in chronic and you do some work and you get yourself to a point where you say, okay, now I can go down to the basic level and I feel pretty good. An occasional issue comes up and you're like, okay, I've got a flu or a cold. And it's like, so I'm going to bump up my vitamin C, and, you know, feel a little bit better, put a little bit more energy in the tank, give my body what it needs to fight this illness.
That's correct. You know, our bodies are changing all the time. Our environment is changing all the time, you know, from the seasons, you know, with age, with the infections that are available. So there is no one regime that you have to do and that's it for life. And, you know, we have to box clever. We have to think about what's happening. But the bottom line is, if you've got plenty of physical energy and mental energy and emotional energy, then there's not a lot wrong. And say the best guide to health is symptoms, how you feel, what you can achieve, what you can do. And, you know, fatigue has almost become the norm because Western people eat these very high carbohydrate diets. And at the beginning of the book, I detail all the symptoms that I commonly hear from my patients, which tell me that the energy balance is beginning to narrow. Either their energy bucket is getting smaller, or they are wasting energy on basal metabolism, chronic infection, allergy, autoimmunity, or whatever. And the gap gives us the symptoms. And just one little aside here. Very often, the first thing people do when their energy gap starts to narrow is they use addiction to mask the symptoms. Now, that is very dangerous medicine because, you know, as I mentioned before, if you spend more energy than you have available to you, you die. And sometimes you hear on the radio about some, you know, young person who's gone to a disco dance and taken ecstasy and alcohol and danced all night and gone mad and probably felt wonderful, and then they drop dead. Now, you never hear about the mechanism of death, but my guess is that those drugs have masked that symptom that says you've got to stop, you've got to rest. They've masked it so much that they have overspent and they haven't got the energy for the heart to work, and bang, down they go.
Well, that's deep stuff, you know, because I think people see it, you know, if you've ever seen an animal at the end die, you see the energy leave. I mean, you quite literally, you're sitting there and 1 minute it's got energy and the next it doesn't. And, you know, we had to put down our Chihuahua Jojo last year. And that was, you know, that was one of the things we had to deal with was, you know, he was suffering and it was time, but you just, it's just like in one moment there's energy and then the next there's not. And so energy is extremely important to the way we feel it. And as you said in the book, energy is life.
Yes. Energy is life. And I now see the whole of life from the energy perspective. I mean, even human relationships, and you know, if you have, you know, a human relationship, if both parties are putting the same amount of energy into that relationship, it works incredibly well. But if you get a major disparity and there's not a lot of love between, maybe to help smooth that over, if you get one person who's constantly putting energy in and the other who's constantly taking it, then that will result in discord. And I see that in so many, you know, human relations.
Dr. Mihail, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are three strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
Well, the one biggest and most important is the diet, because food causes fatigue in so many different ways. Food, if you have a lot of refined junk food and carbohydrates, is just toxic. It's just directly poisonous to the body, as we've described. Sugars and carbohydrates are not good fuels for the mitochondria. And putting sugars into the body is like, I mean, I've got an old car out there that runs on diesel. And if I put petrol in the tank, it'll chunder on for a bit, but it doesn't like it, and it'll eventually pack up and stop working. And the third point is allergy. We're now seeing epidemics of allergy. And allergy means you're reacting allergically to foods, and that means the immune system is activated with inflammation. And if the immune system is active with inflammation, that is taking energy, because the immune system demands a lot of energy. And worse than that, it's causing symptoms as well. Migraine, irritable bowel, arthritis, or whatever. So it's diet, diet, diet. And that really is the, you know, the starting point. And the problem with giving people a list of, oh, it's three things, is they will cherry pick the easy things. They'll say, oh, that Dr. Meyer, she said diet, she said supplements, and she said, oh, take some adrenal support. Oh, well, the supplements and the adrenal support, that sounds easy, I'll do that. And they don't bother with the diet. So the diet is the most difficult thing, but it's also the most important thing. And when you've got that in place, everything else falls into place. And it's not a difficult diet. It's very doable. You know, I do it all the time, and so do my patients. And without that, the other interventions downstream simply don't work. You know, you can have a Formula One engine, you know, in pole position, but if you put the wrong fuel in the tank, it's not going to make the first lap. So the diet is critical.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Mihail, if someone wanted to learn more about you or the book, The Energy Equation, From Naked Ape to Knackered Ape, where would you like for me to send them?
Well, I have my website where all my information is available free for nothing. My books are available there. But these days, what is very popular is I do Zoom workshops. And because the basic workup to treating absolutely everything is the same, I can treat 20 people at a time. And they have proved very popular. And so I have 20 people there. I start talking at 9:30 in the morning. I finish at 4:00 in the afternoon. At any point, anybody can just wave at me. I don't understand this. What do you mean? What can I eat? And I stop and talk from that. And I feel I can do 20 people at a time because the basic workup, the groundhog regimes are now so standard. And sometimes you just need a little bit of enthusiasm from somebody like you, from somebody like me, to really be a wake-up call and make people think, do you know what? I've got to do that. And these people do love these interactive regimes because if I say something that they don't get or they don't believe, they can challenge me straight away and I can come back with what I think is a good and a coherent, you know, response. But all the answers are in the books. But say some people that there are videos of me online on YouTube. If you Google Life, the Basic Manual, there are various vignettes of me doing video stuff. I say, or join a workshop and we can have some fun there.
Okay. The address for that website is?
It's just drmyhill.co.uk.
Okay.
If you put Myhill in, my website has lots of hits and it usually comes up fairly high up.
Okay. Well, I'll have this in the show notes. So you can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/474 and I'll have the link there. Dr. Myhill, thank you so much for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness.
Alan, my absolute pleasure. You ask all the right questions and that makes my life very easy.
Thank you. Raz, welcome back.
Hey, Ellen. Wow, what an amazing interview. I mean, who isn't fatigued at this age of our lives?
Yeah, you know, sometimes you don't even know what you don't even know because you're so in it that you don't even have a concept that you are fatigued. You know, it's like people just expect, okay, I'm a little older, I'm going to be tired. That's going to be a normal state. And it doesn't have to be a normal state all the time. There's some people are dealing with issues and just don't know it because that's their normal. They wake up that way. They're that way every day. You notice things when there's a drastic change from what you're doing, but, and I've said this before and someone said that's kind of morbid and you shouldn't say that. But anyway, I've got to say it again. Is this the boiling the frog? You know, if you try to toss a frog into boiling water, it'll hop right back out. It'll get out of there pretty quick because the water's hot and it senses that it's hot. It's a drastic difference from not hot. And then, but if you put the frog in regular water and you slowly bring it to a boil, the frog doesn't recognize that the water's beginning to get too hot and you'll actually boil the frog. So I don't condone boiling frogs. So don't tell people I'm boiling frogs that I've ever done this. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it doesn't work that way, but that's what I've been told. Anyway, if we don't have something to compare and contrast to, then we really don't know what's what. And for a lot of people, when they do try ketosis, obviously they'll go through potentially a keto flu, or I call it carb withdrawals, where they're struggling. Their energy levels are dropping dramatically and they feel really, you know, really bad, almost like flu-like symptoms. And then their body starts using ketones and they feel great. And, you know, that's an awesome feeling. When you get into ketosis and you for that little bit of time, you're feeling great. The thing is, then great becomes your normal. And then great is normal. And and so people kind of feel like maybe they've lost a little bit of that, but no, you're still feeling great. Yeah. So the whole fatigue side and whole thing is just realize that if you're not having drastic swings, you might not recognize which side of the fence you're on. So trying some nutritional therapies, different things can be a way to at least recognize when things are working well and when they're not. Now, but if you know that you're struggling with fatigue, then this might be an approach that would be advantageous to you to help you get past that. So it's always worth trying something just to see how your body responds, see how you feel, And if you're going to do those types of things, I always encourage folks to do a journal, because sometimes we kind of just forget what something felt like, because, you know, it was then. And we might not think it was as drastic a change as it was, but if you sit down and write down symptoms you're going through, and then you go through a protocol like this or an elimination diet or something like that, at least at that point, you've got some baseline to go back and read and say, oh, I forgot I was only sleeping 3 hours a night. Now I'm sleeping through the night. That's new. But you might not have thought about sleep because that wasn't why you were changing or doing your intervention.
That is interesting. Isn't sleep is one of those things that we just put in the back of our head, not even thinking that it's something that we could change. You know, when I came to keto, I did it for the very reason you just said. I was feeling not right. I was not feeling energetic. I was definitely getting fatigued, and I have struggled with fatigue, usually iron deficiencies. So about 3 years ago, I thought, well, I'll do the same experiment. We'll try keto. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I did have the exact same thing you just mentioned. I went through the keto flu. And then once I got my energy back, once I switched over to burning fat for fuel, man, I felt like $1 million. And it really worked really well for me. And it is an experiment worth trying for sure.
Yeah. Now I fell into ketosis the first time kind of on accident. And I've told this story before, but, you know, I was worried about my health. I'd kind of reached that stage of commitment. And so I went to a doctor and I said, okay, look, I've got to fix me. I'm broken. I'm just broken. And I've been broken for a long time and everything I've tried hasn't worked. So I'm going to ask for help. And, you know, sometimes it's just that, you know, hiring someone, bringing someone else in to get other perspectives, to get some guidance, to get some support, and maybe even some accountability. Those are valuable things. And so I invested in a doctor and he had a nutritionist on board. So, you know, I met with him and he talked about exercise and other things. And he was built, he was muscular and 10 years older, 15 years older than me. And I'm like, okay, I got to listen to this guy. Anyway, I get in with a nutritionist and she's like, do you know what paleo is? And I was like, no, not really. And she said, okay, it's this. And I'm like, oh, so food. Yeah. Actually eat things that were actually meant to be food, which was plants and animals and eggs and seeds. And that's pretty much it. And you know, that was the answer. That was actually the answer. And so I started eating paleo and just my basic eating habits. I like meat. And once I was off of bread and pasta and rice, and at that point, even beans, potatoes, I felt great. And I just, you know, for one reason or another, kept kind of pushing more meat in because I was lifting and I wanted the protein. And, you know, just end up eating more protein. And when you eat protein and you're full, then there's not as much room for other carbs. So the carbs went down. And then, you know, suddenly I noticed, okay, my energy level is like through the roof. And I'm feeling really good. And my breath kind of smells funny. And so I started doing some research and that's when I found out about ketosis. And so I'm at this point, you know, looking up podcasts and looking up articles to just figure out what the heck's going on. And, you know, that's when I started learning what ketosis was in the first place. So it wasn't someone telling me you should try the keto diet. It was just a happy accident. And to kind of give you an idea of what that can mean and realize I wasn't just changing what I ate. I was working on my sleep. I was working on my stress and I was exercising like a beast. Lifting weights, making sure I had plenty of protein, doing some cardio work, working grip strength because I had in my heart, I was going to do a Tough Mudder with my daughter. And I put the money up and I signed up for it. It was, you know, I had like 9 months or 8 months to prepare for it. And so I was training for that. I kind of became an obsession at that point that I was going to be ready for that race. And I lost just on paleo. I lost about 25 pounds. So, you know, going from roughly, I'd say, December, starting December and then getting into late December and then getting into by March when I did a warrior dash with some friends and my daughter, I had lost about 25 pounds and, but it wasn't really showing. I couldn't really see it. I couldn't see that I'd lost that weight. I still, in my mind, looked huge. And then I ended up in ketosis and I dropped another 40.
Wow.
And because I was lifting weights, I then also, I mean, that was all fat. So I lost 65 pounds or 66 pounds of fat and I gained 11 pounds of muscle. And I know that because the doctor I went to, he did a DEXA scan when he saw me the first time. And then I went back to his office, you know, 11 months later after I finished the Tough Mudder and I had lost that weight. I'd gone from 37% body fat down to 19.
Wow.
So the PK diet can be really, really effective for weight loss. But as we learned in this interview, it has a lot of other benefits. We talked about fatigue, but you know, even the other issues, cancers, heart disease, diabetes, maybe even some forms of dementia. So there's a lot of benefits to this way of eating. And so I, you know, I'd encourage anyone who's suffering and struggling and you haven't tried keto, the paleo keto is kind of, in my mind, kind of an optimal diet for most people for periods of time. You don't have to stay in ketosis, but just recognize that you probably still want to generally eat paleo all the time, or at least eat whole foods. You know, if it wasn't alive at some point, crawling around or growing in the ground, you know, you probably don't want to eat it.
Right. Yeah. And that's worth mentioning too, that we are talking about whole foods, real foods, plants and animals. You know, I people harp on the keto diet for the bacon part of it, but, and people have a hard time giving up breads, but sugar is also the other enemy that it is worth giving up for sure. You don't need to bring that back.
Yeah. And that's true. I mean, you know, only sugars I would condone, if I'm going to condone sugars at all, is if you like fruit, have some fruit, you know, but I do know my body well enough to know that I can't really tolerate tropical fruits very well. My blood sugar is going to spike and, you know, that's not going to be in my best interest over time, for my blood sugar to spike when I'm eating fruit. So, I eat very limited tropical fruits. So I may occasionally have a banana. I might occasionally have a little bit of mango. Like if there's a breakfast bar and there's some mango, I might have a little bit, and maybe a little bit of pineapple here and there. But for the most part, if I'm going to have fruit, it's going to be berries, it's going to be apples, pears. That's going to be the bulk of it. And, you know, it works for me. I can still have my pears and apples and berries and still be in ketosis.
Well, for sure. I mean, unless it's something you're intolerant to or even allergic to, there's nothing wrong with having and enjoying a fruit or something every now and then, as long as it agrees with you. It's not something you have to totally eliminate forever.
Yeah. And that's kind of one of the core things, is be willing to experiment, try something, see how it works. You know, something as simple as having a blood glucose meter and, you know, having a piece of fruit, having a piece of mango, or having a bit of apple or a bit of berries, and just seeing what it actually does, you know? And so I've been periods of time where I was checking my ketones all the time. You know, I was using a breath meter, so it was not that expensive. I paid for the meter, and then I have it. But I could see if I ate some fruit, a particular tropical fruit, my ketones went away. And they went away for about as long as I figure it took my body to burn that extra sugar off. And then once it was done, you know, I was able to get back into ketosis. So, you know, just realize that it's worth experimenting with different things. Don't poo-poo things. Everybody likes to say, oh, keto's a fad diet. Well, it's only a fad diet that's been around since like the 1800s, because it's just had different names over time. But there's text that goes all the way back to the early 1800s where they're talking about, if you want to lose some pounds, cut your carbs. It's been an idea that's been out there for centuries. And so for people to poo-poo it and say it's just another fad, and it's just like Atkins, just like South Beach, I'm like, well, those are just names for branding, to brand something that people wanted to sell something and make some money with, an idea that's been around for a long, long time. And our ancestors knew that. If you're eating carbs, you're going to be putting on weight, which, you know, if you're living in caveman times, not a bad plan, you know, to be putting on a little bit of body fat. Because as you, if you listen to the episode I had with Dr. Fedewa and Dr. Esko, I mean, that was the cycle. You have access to fruit and those things. You put on a little bit of weight. That's going to help keep you warm in the winter. That's going to give you some excess energy when food's a little bit scarce. And then in the winter, there's no fruit. So now you're hunting animals and, you know, getting fat and protein. And, you know, now you're burning through some of those carbs you ate during the summer and spring. And that's a good thing. And that's how our body was designed. We weren't designed for having ready access to food all the time. We weren't, you know, developed around the process that we would have so much food available. And then the carbs, you know, just you walk in the grocery store, your great grandparents walked into one of our grocery stores right now, they would not recognize 99% of what's in there as actual food.
Right.
They would walk around the outside and say, okay, this is the grocery store. What do they sell in there? What do they sell in the middle? Because they wouldn't know most of it. You said, oh, well, these are cheese puffs. Like,
cheese puffs. It's so weird.
Yeah. Yes. You know, oh, yep. These are good. And I'm like, okay, well, yeah, but they're not food. they're food no. stuff. It started with stuff that was in food. And then it went horribly, horribly wrong. And yeah, if you want to eat some of that stuff, is it going to kill you? Overall, probably not. But if that's the core of what you're subsisting on and trying to live like a teenager or college kid on pizza and cheese puffs and Dr. Pepper or soda, whatever it is, no, you're not going to live long. You're just not. You're making choices that are not going to serve you. And it won't take you long to figure it out. Spend a month eating that way and just you see it. It's called the COVID-15. So, you know, you got to try something to know if it's going to work, and you got to try something to know what it's going to do if it's not going to work.
Right. And the other half of that equation, of course, I am the runner. And so you need to move, you need to exercise. And when you eat foods like that, you don't feel so good when you exercise. Mm-hmm. It doesn't give you the energy that you need. No matter how much sugar or energy drinks you can shove down, it's not going to feel good. Your body's going to feel tired later anyway. And all of the work that you're doing in the gym or running around like I do, it's going to backfire altogether. I'm pretty particular about what I like to eat because I know how my body responds to food. I've mentioned in the past that my body likes red meat better than white meat. You know, I could eat steaks all day long and chicken meat just does not do it for me. And I can tell on my runs. So, you know, you'll get to feeling better when you clean up the diet a little bit better.
Absolutely. All right, Raz. Well, I guess I'll see you next week then. Hey,
you bet. Sounds great. Take care.
Next time on the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we bring back Phoebe Lapine and discuss her book, SIBO Made Simple. Until then, have a happy and healthy week.